The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
All right, everyone, if you'll start to gather towards your seats, we're going to get started here in a minute. We have plenty of ground to cover here today. I can tell I have a bunch of well-behaved classical educators. That was much faster than most places I'm at. We are definitely not at the American Montessori Society. I'll just say that right now. Although I love my little Montessorians. They're cute. Well, good morning. I hope you've had a good morning here. Has this conference been good for you guys so far? Good, good. It looks like there were some interesting subjects. Unfortunately, the way my life is, I'm doing emails, as many of you are, in between, so I don't get to enjoy as a passenger quite as much these days. So first, just let me give you a great apology, which is, of course, the poorest of rhetorical form. But this is going to be a challenge for me because I was ADHD before ADHD was cool. And standing behind this podium in this static way is going to be probably a source of great humor for many of you, as you observe. In fact, I'm going to do a test here real quick. If I step out here and talk like this, can you hear me in the back? No? Well, so much for ADHD. Well, first of all, it is a delight to be here. And I mean that not just because that's the sort of polite thing that we say at these occasions, but because really my roots as an educator really found themselves in the classical movement. I'll never forget at 17 when I had a professor pull me aside and he said, "Bill, you know, I think you're really a classicist at heart." And I thought I was just a weird kid that read books that nobody else wanted to read. And as time went on, I got introduced to the great conversation, and it changed my life, as it has for many here in this room. It was very, very powerful for me. And some of the best times, and I say that literally, some of the best times of my life were in a room full of eighth graders teaching logic, rhetoric, and worldview, and really hopefully impacting lives and giving them a schema, as my father would say, to engage the culture through. If I have any regret working for ISM, though I love what I do, I certainly miss the eighth graders. In fact, I work with a variety of boards whom I feel my eighth graders would be good role models for. I'm sure you know that story all too well. So listen, my name is Bill Simmer. I'm here today to talk with you about enrollment demand, a subject that is of interest to no one here in this room, I'm sure. And the reason I want to talk to you about enrollment demand is there's a lot of stinking thinking going on around there, that's a technical term, about enrollment demand and about what drives it and about how we create that. And in particular, there's a lot of naysaying now. The sky is falling. You know, we have no demographic. Nobody wants to pay tuitions anymore for private independent schools. Woe is me. Woe is me. And even a couple of professional organizations are perpetrating that. Of course, as some of you know, when you start to scratch below the surface, the data seems to be lacking, both on the individual school level and in the broader level. So what I'd like to do here today, as we're here together, first of all, I want you to see this email address. This is not crass marketing. I want to send you some goodies, some articles. Because we're going to talk about it in the next hour and 40 minutes, which would normally be about 2 weeks of instruction. Sure. And so what I want to do is I want to be able to send you some articles. So I will not put you on a mailing list unless you ask. This is a legitimate, just send me an email. I will forward this to my able assistant, who's actually the person in charge, and she will move those in your direction. Please be kind this time of year. It may take a week for you to get them. But I hope you will. And the reason why I think that that's important is there's no way in the time that we have allotted, I'm going to tell you how to go and create a model faculty, and by the way, just as an aside, create an effective parent relations program in an hour and 40 minutes. If you're expecting that, I'm here to disappoint you. That won't happen. So what am I here to do? What I'm here to do is I'm here to start to paint a picture for many of you. Some of you may have heard some of this language. I was talking with a gentleman here. He said some of you have used our faculty culture profile and some other things. So for some of you who've worked with ISM or read our materials, some of this vocabulary will be familiar. For others of you, it will not be. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to accomplish at least this of getting some of the mushy kumbaya talk out of this subject of faculty culture. Because faculty culture is actually a very robust, well-researched thing. We ourselves have spent the past 30 years researching it with at least 4 studies on it. And so it's actually something that I feel very confident about and concrete about. And I want you to get rid of the smell of marshmallows and the strumming of a camp guitar at the campfire. And I want you to get serious about working and creating a healthy faculty culture. So I want to make sure that you understand what that is. The other thing is I wanted to begin to introduce the concepts to you, for those of you who don't know it, of what we call a PREP, or a Parent Retention and Education Program. And this is going to be instrumental in working with parents and bonding parents to you. So I want to talk a little bit about that, and that's also a subject that often is misconstrued or has some alleyways that people have gone down that haven't been very productive for them. And, of course, the last thing I want to do is help you to focus on the difference makers. We have a wide range of schools here. Some of you are very small, in the hundreds, 150s, maybe even less. Others of you are larger and have a more complex organization. But one thing I've learned in working with leaders for 13 years is that the big difference maker, the thing that divides, dare I say, good leaders from great leaders, one of those core factors is this, that great leaders understand what the difference makers are in their industry. And they more than just know that cognitively, but they order their time, their resources, and their personnel in such a way as to reflect what those difference makers are. That is to say, from the negative point of view, they are not caught in the whirlwind of the tyranny of the urgent, at least not all the time. They're setting aside some time for themselves to say, here are the things that matter most. Here are the 20% of what I do that's going to impact 80% of my organization. And so while I would never want to encourage anyone here to not have a great website or to not engage in effective social media communications with parents or to not have any number of things, a nice brochure or any of that, what I want you to understand, if you understand nothing from our time here together, is that that is all for naught if you don't have a faculty culture that backs it up. Your industry is much like mine. You are not a direct point of sale industry where you sell something to somebody, say, see, you wouldn't want to be it, and hope that they don't fulfill the return policy. Your constituents are coming up to your facility 5 days a week at least, and they are pulling up in a parking lot, and they are chatting with each other and with others about your performance. Interestingly enough, they're probably not chatting with you about it. But they have an opinion about it all the same. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to start off at this Christian classical conference by teaching a little bit of Eastern mysticism here. I can see the evals already. I almost didn't use this, but I'm going to assume that we have humor as well. I call it the marketing mantra because even before I was an employee at ISM, when I was a client of ISM, this was what they called it. They called it the marketing mantra. This is a very powerful statement, and it's pregnant with meaning. And in many ways, the time that I'm going to be spending here at this conference is going to be spent unpacking this. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about the money piece, for those of you who are interested. Today, right now, we're going to talk about the performance piece, our faculty culture, delivering to students. And then after lunch, after the insulin is pulsing through your veins and you're all asleep, We're going to talk about validation. What does it mean to validate? So really, this is a good outline, but this is about as campy as I'm going to get. I might get a little campier than this, but I'm going to ask all of you very educated and sophisticated people out there to indulge me, and I'd like us all to say this together and get this mantra in our head. So here's what it is. It's money follows performance when validated. Can we all say that together? Money follows performance when validated. One more time for the campfire. Money follows performance when validated. So what do I mean by that? Money, tuition, annual fund, capital campaign, the ability to build an endowment, the ability to pay my faculty what they deserve and what Christ calls us to pay. Performance. We're going to talk a lot about that, but at the end of the day, what I'm going to say to you is this. Performance is delivering on the promises that you've made in the admissions office. So we're going to call it that for now, but we want to talk about performance. And validation. Validation is the knowledge that despite the fact that our parents and ourselves are Christians and that there's a metaphysic involved, we are at the end of the day mammals. I'm sorry, we just are. And so we share some mammalian traits, even though we have a soul and a spirit. And part of that is that I need to be reinforced. If you want to bond with me, if you want to connect with me, if you want me to not feel alienated from you, I need you to reinforce. And if my experience with you is a little bit of the shock stick monkey thing, then you'll be surprised. You'll be shocked to know that I'm actually not having a groovy relationship with you. That's another technical term. So let's talk about faculty culture. So the first thing I would say, do we have any admissions officers here in the room? Any? Just raise your hands proudly. I was an admissions officer. I love admissions officers. By the way, they make the best heads. School, I'm just telling you, former admissions officers. So shout out. If I were going to ask you, and if you don't know, I won't embarrass you, but if I were going to say, how many of your new inquiries from families are influenced by an existing referral from an existing parent or student, what percentage would it be? Shout it out to me. I'm hearing 75, so I'm hearing 90s, I'm hearing 100. That sounds about right. Yeah. In our experience, what we find is that about 75 to 90% of new inquiries come from existing families. So once again, you are a referral industry. If I can use my own industry, those of you who've gone to the ISM website, you know that we have a very complex website. In fact, more complex than I'd like to talk about. It's very painful. And a host of marketing. In fact, if you're on our list, you're probably getting stuff in the mail from us. You're getting all kinds of things from us. We are certainly marketing. We are not ignoring our image in the marketplace. But at the end of the day, if you hire us and pay the high fees that we charge, you are doing it for one reason and one reason only. That's because you picked up the phone and called another head of school and said, I have a problem. Who should I talk to? You are a referral industry. So here's what I want to say to you, classicists. The faculty's the thing to catch the heart of the king. Or, in this case, the queen, because we know who really makes the decisions in these regards. So the faculty is everything. If I want to have enrollment, I need to have a strong faculty culture. If I want to be able to raise money effectively, I need to have a strong faculty culture. If I want to have better teachers come and want to be there and stay, and by the way, one of the great spin-offs of this is if I want ineffective teachers to feel really uncomfortable, like on a daily basis, I want this. I want a healthy faculty culture. And though I don't talk about it a lot, I just want to say it is very powerful to know that one of the things that a healthy faculty culture is it's something that causes dysfunctional faculty members to self-select out. Because now it's not just the pressure coming from you, it's the pressure coming from all of my peers. A good pressure, a positive pressure, an uplifting pressure, but a pressure all the same. So I want to talk to you about what it is that we're trying to accomplish. What are we looking for in a healthy faculty culture? I was on the phone with a Christian school about a year and a half ago. Wonderful Christian school, great Christian educator, struggling with enrollment demand. So I said, well, tell me about your faculty. And this is what she said to me. She said, very bravely, bold, she didn't hesitate. She said, my faculty are all certified, my faculty all have master's degrees, and my faculties all love Christ. In 20 years, I would have gone, go, girl. That sounds great. I would have done it in Latin, but anyway, I would have said, that sounds great. But what I said to her on the phone 20 years later is that that's very great, that's exciting, but you just told me three correlates that tell me nothing about how effective your teachers are with children. Those of you who've been in education for a while know that the holy grail of certification has failed us. It takes very little to pass a test and get into certification. Master's degrees, well, I have a couple of them, probably more than my father wanted me to pursue. And I can here to tell you that there's no conclusive study on master's degrees impacting K through 12 instruction. In fact, for everyone that seems to indicate it's positive, I can show you a couple that'll say that, particularly in the maths and sciences, that if you get too educated, you begin to not be able to relate well with K through 12 kids. And the one that's most relevant for us, a believer in Jesus Christ. Brothers and sisters, here's what I want to tell you right now, and I say this out of love, and you're going to think, some of you, that I mean. There are a host of people that love the Lord, that are giving to the Lord, that are serving the Lord, that have no business teaching your classes. And one thing you better do as a Christian school leader is get off that square that Jesus makes it all okay, and somehow this person who has no skills or traits is going to do great in my classroom because somehow they love Jesus. Now, could he do it? Sure. But I think it's pretty presumptuous of you to expect that to happen. I think it's much more likely that that person needs to go on the journey that God prepared them for with the skill set that God prepared them for, and that what you need to solicit are people who, yes, love Jesus Christ. In fact, I might even add, are engaged in a powerful relationship with Jesus Christ, but that also are effective instructors. So what are the difference makers? What are the things that in the 40 years that ISM has worked with private independent schools make a difference? So there are four things, and in classic Monty Python fashion, I'll say no, but five. So that's a great thing. At a classical convention, I know that there are Monty Python fans here, and I know that you're all closet Monty Python fans because you can't, you know. It's like Baptist deacons at the liquor store. sorry, it's terrible. So here are the four things that you have in a powerful faculty. A powerful faculty, first of all, knows, understands, and concretizes the mission, and we're going to talk about that. And I hope that's another thing that we're going to do is get the mission out of airy-fairy, esoteric land, get it off that plaque on the wall collecting dust, completely irrelevant to your day-to-day planning. I mean, not your school, but others. I've heard are that way. And we want to talk about what it means to take a mission and make it concretized and alive and running through our decision making, our programmatic elements, everything. A mission that matters. So healthy faculty cultures we see have that. And the majority of faculty cultures I work with, even though the administrators assure me that they all own the mission, when I come to their schools, none of them can tell me what the mission is. The mission is completely irrelevant from their practice. And in fact, what I have is as many missions as I have individuals in the room. Now, there's an aspect of that that's great, but there's also an aspect where we have to have that covenantal unity about what we're trying to do in the lives of children. So the second thing we see in healthy faculty is that they are predictable and supportive, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to explain that a little bit more. The other thing we see about healthy faculty is that they are ongoing, growing professional development machines. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about that we're going to talk about. But here's what I want to say to you in short. If you want to create lifelong learners, how many of you want to create lifelong learners? Okay. I actually have some hands that didn't go up. That's kind of sad. You must be tired. I got a secret for you. You ready for this? If you want to create lifelong learners, your teachers need to be lifelong learners too. You can't model what you don't live. Not for very long. Not for very long. So the final thing is you need to be child-centric, to which everyone says, well, duh. But we're going to talk about that a little bit, because I don't know that we are always as student-centric as we think we are. So let's talk a little bit about it. So first of all, when it comes to missions, when I first came to ISM, we actually had a crisis as an organization. We were beginning to question whether missions were relevant, which is pretty bad when you are an organization that says our job is to help you fulfill your mission. But it was a serious internal dialogue, because our experience was this. Most missions were very all over the place. They all sounded about the same. When we went into schools, there was no reference to them. It wasn't impacting decision making. It was irrelevant to the day-to-day life of the school. And we were beginning to wonder, is it just fancy talk, to quote SpongeBob? Is it just fancy talk, this stuff about mission? And so we went on our own search. And those organizations that were making it happen, what were they doing? And so through years of observation, this is what we've determined. So the first thing I want to say to you is that the mission is not enough. The mission is not enough. You really need three what I'm going to call thought documents. Thought documents that represent what your community is committed to, the essence of your community, why you exist. So the first is your mission. And here's what I want to say about your mission. The great enemy of your mission is your attempt to be comprehensive. I want to say that again. Your great enemy of your mission is your attempt to be comprehensive. If I read another whole child, biblically based, academically rigorous, global citizen, biblical worldview, oh my goodness gracious, blah, blah, blah. I'm shocked that this school actually, they're teaching at this school. That's amazing. The mission of this school is to teach. Oh, wow. And they added the word rigor. Oh, I'm getting all woolly. As in rigor mortis. I can drive a truck through Christian worldview. If I tested all of you right now, and this is a pretty homogeneous group, if I tested you right now and said, what in 3 minutes, write down what a Christian worldview is, there would certainly be some overlap, but there would be an incredible amount of disparity. And woe to the Arminians in this room. That's all I have to say. I'd keep that quiet. So the first thing we need is a mission that is powerful and that really talks about what your marketing niche is. This is what I need out of a mission. I need a mission to exist that if I spread all my admissions brochures out, that the thing that makes me different, the thing that if my school left the marketplace, kids would not be getting, that's the thing that I want to be my mission. My one, two, or at most, marketing distinguishers, what makes me different. That's the first thing I would do. And the second thing I would do is I would have a mission that had meaning for my community. So here you go. Here's a little cute thing. Meaning trumps words every day. Meaning trumps words. So here's a great mission that I'll just use as an example. It's not a Christian school. The head is a Christian. This school is turned around. This school was about to close down. It's not the only reason this school is thriving now and getting ready to add a high school, but it is one of the reasons. They reevaluated their mission. And so here's the mission of the Piedmont School. Strives daily to be the educational oasis that quenches the thirst of students who learn differently. Wow. You know, on their campus, they've got banners all over the place. And here's what it says. Quench your thirst. Quench your thirst. I called and talked with the receptionist and somehow got on the subject of the mission. And the receptionist was alive and bubbly and engaged because children were quenching their thirst here at this school and everybody understood it. This is superior to our school. We'll provide a Christ-centered education based in the classical model along with 50 other schools in our generalized area. The mission needs to be different. Now, I can't spend a lot of time on that because time's our enemy right now. But the other thing I want you to see is that we have to have a portrait of the graduate. And perhaps for our purposes today, this is the more relevant one. So what is a portrait of the graduate? A portrait of the graduate are the 3, 4, or 5 things that my school, my faculty, my community is committing to create in the lives of graduates of this institution. 3, 4, 5. You can't do more than that. Guys, the research is just insurmountable. If you try to change everything, you'll change nothing. You'll have sustained mediocrity. You have to pick what you're good at, and much more than about five outcomes in students. And you better have a robust operation and a lot of money to do it, because every one of those items has a dollar tag attached to it, right, in order for you to pull that off. So three to five at the most. And what I want is I want specific outcomes, and I want outcomes that, if possible, they can't always be, but if possible, can be measured. Because as Drucker, the guru of all management, says, what gets measured, anybody can finish that, gets done. What gets measured gets done. Live it, know it, apply it to your school. So I want a portrait of the graduate, and I don't want some airy-fairy, all-over-the-place portrait of the graduate. I want something that is specific, that's concise. And in fact, if I can, I want to have as little educator ease in it as possible, because I want it to be something that my faculty can understand, my students themselves at a certain age can understand, my parents can understand. I want it to be very, very concrete. So let's look at a couple. I just put these on last night, just thinking back to my classical days, a couple that I would have loved to have seen. So here you go. Our graduates will give of their time, talents, and money to those in need, both locally and around the globe. Wow, that's way different than Christian worldview, isn't it? I mean, Christian worldview is all over the place. Give me a lifetime and I'll be teaching them a Christian worldview. What aspect of the Christian worldview would you like to focus on? But I can teach them this. This is focused. This is a really important part of the Christian worldview. And here it is. And you know what's great about this? I might actually take this to a meeting and it might inform programmatic decisions or curricular decisions or hiring decisions or reimbursement decisions. This could be used to concretize the mission. Are you ready for this? I might actually survey my alumni 5 years later and see if they're actually doing this. Right? Crazy sauce. Okay, so let's go on to another one. Our graduates develop a daily devotional life and intimate relationship with God that will last a lifetime. I'll tell you what, as somebody who pursued a theological, philosophical education most of my life, including a focus on the simplicity of God, which is anything but simple for those of you who are theologians, here's what I want to tell you at 53. After all that work, and it wasn't a waste of time, and it was certainly helpful, but let me tell you what, that is what I seek the most. That's what the ongoing struggle in the midst of the turmoil is. Am I connected? It's not how rigorous it was. So, we want to know specifically the outcomes that we are creating in the lives of our graduates, and we want to respond in our programmatic decisions, in our hiring, and in all of our decision-making based upon those things. The last piece that we have, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, is the characteristics of professional excellence. So, in a word, here's what it is. If I know what my marketing niche is, what my distinctive is in my mission, and if I know what the specific outcomes I'm trying to create in the lives of the children in my care are, now what I have is the beginning of a conversation about what are the characteristics and behaviors and attitudes that I need from my faculty to deliver that outcome and mission. I want to say that again. What do I need from my faculty, not the faculty down the street, not the faculty in the next city, not the faculty at the classical school that's run by my friend. There may be some overlap there, but I need to know the faculty that I need to deliver what I've said we're trying to do in the lives of children. You know, I joked about my Montessori peeps, but as many of you know, they have this obsession with environmentalism and things. I guess that's probably a good thing. Between you, as an aside, I never understood how Christians let other people take the environmental movement. I don't see anything that indicates that we're still not supposed to be stewards. That was our original job, right? Gardeners, and what a great life. We blew it, didn't we? So anyway, so here's a school that says we are committed to environmentalism. We have six different places in the D.C. area. We have conservation areas in every one of them, and they were having a crisis with their faculty because some of their faculty were really teaching that well and others weren't. And so I came in, and the first thing I said is, well, can I see your faculty interview forms? And they were like, what? not a single question about your engagement with environmental studies. And I am now shocked to see that we have faculty on staff that aren't doing it. It happens with advisory all the time. We have an advisory program at the school that's at the core. It ensures that we have deep and meaningful relationships with our students. And we've hired half of our faculty that have no interest in that advisory program. You need to know what teacherness looks like at your school. Your school, not the other schools. Your school. And so when I know the specific outcomes I'm trying to create, when I know what my marketing niche is, now I can begin to say, what attitudes and behaviors do I need? Some of those are going to overlap with other schools. I mean, I need people that can manage a classroom. I need people that can relate well with parents. I can't imagine a school where you wouldn't have those, but some of those are going to be very unique to you. And those represent your characteristics of excellence. So the first thing I want to say about a healthy faculty culture is that they know who they are, they know their reason for being, and they know what that looks like at their school. They know what teacherness is here. The second thing we see from effective faculty cultures is that they are predictable and supportive. And so what do I mean by predictable and supportive? Whew, wow, that clock is just... So here's what I mean by predictable and supportive. In my view, it's at the heart of teaching. And I mean that sincerely. So here's what I would say. Predictable and supportive cultures, I want you to think of it like a railroad track. They run together. And they're inseparable. If you have a lot of one and not much of the other, you're not in a good situation. You're not on the 50-yard line. They come together. They're a package. So healthy faculty cultures are first predictable. They are very clear about what their expectations are of everyone in the system. You do not get hired by a predictable culture and told 3 weeks after you're hired that you're expected to come to 50% of the home games. You know that in the interview process. You know what it means to be a teacher in this context, and really in school cultures as a whole, when predictability and supportiveness begins to manifest itself at all of the various levels, what you have is students who are very clear about what the expectations of them are. You have board members who are very clear about, wouldn't that be nice, about what the expectations of them are. Everybody understands not just their own role, but the role of others within the system. And that is the responsibility of leadership to develop, document, articulate, and hold accountable for. These are our expectations. But here's the other thing. Expectations alone are nothing short of draconian. And I go to a lot of Christian schools where they're strong on this, but the second part is not forthcoming, and that is support. If I'm going to expect you to perform, I'm going to provide you with the resources necessary to succeed in what I'm asking of you. Those resources are money, space, time, other personnel, professional development, support, counseling, whatever it takes. I'm going to give you what you need to succeed at what I'm asking you to do. And I'm not going to develop a whole bunch of religious jargon and stain Christendom by making a bunch of theological excuses for why I'm expecting you to do all this, but I don't have any way of giving you all these other resources. Because my Father owns the cattle on a thousand hills. So, predictability and supportiveness. It's a core of effective faculty. And what your faculty need from you is what your students need from your teachers. They need predictability and support. One of the great lines from that I love, you can see it here, there's a line that sort of encompasses it. It says, accurate reinforcement compassionately delivered with a pro-constituent bias. Healthy cultures are accurate in their reinforcement. They don't blow smoke. One of the things I struggle the most with leaders is to get them to stop giving false praise. That's different than saying stop giving praise. But stop giving false praise, because you are undermining the power of your legitimate praise every time a false thing comes out of your mouth. Healthy cultures are accurate, but they're compassionate in the way that they deliver that. and they have a pro-constituent bias. In a perfect world, even as I am terminating an employee, if I've run the right kind of culture, that employee cannot deny that I've worked with them, I've struggled with them, I've done what I can to support them, and that ye would not, but that I have done what I could to see them succeed as a person. In these healthy faculty cultures, when I get peer reviews and peer critique, I don't see it as an affront or an attack. I see it as a gift. And those cultures become very robust. So I'm sorry I'm going to have to run through these a little quickly, but I want you to get the landscape before we talk about what we do about it. So let's talk about the third piece. Healthy faculty cultures are immersed in professional development. This has come under a lot of fire lately with various studies. It's clearly because people are misunderstanding what professional development is. So let me tell you what professional development is that I'm talking about. It is not going to Mexico for a workshop for a week and coming back with some cucarachas and a hat and doing a couple sessions on Mexico and thinking, hey, I got my professional development on. Okay? Cha-cha-cha. It's not that. Professional development happens both individually and corporately. And it's an attitude that to be here on this faculty means you are growing. It means you are growing. The gentleman before just talking was saying, hey, I want to get my faculty's impact. I want to get my faculty's insight. Listen, this is no critique of him. He has to say it. But it kills me that he still has to say it. Of course I want my faculty's input. They're the ones in the mosh pit. They're the ones on the front lines. They're the ones that are impacting my parents. They're the ones that are instructing my students. In fact, I don't just want their input. I want them to be giving their input to each other. I want them to be learning and growing, and then I want them to be integrating those things into their practice in their classroom, and then I want them to be sharing and socializing that knowledge with their peers. I even want that to happen cross-divisionally. Wow. I'll never forget the last school I was at. The high school and the middle school faculty met twice during the year, and the academic leader thought he had really pulled off something because there weren't any fights. All in the name of Jesus. No, I want my faculty engaged with each other. Here's what we don't want to hear. When I talk about those little Danes and those Swedes, those people that are rocking it, and by the way, not rocking it like the East is, the Danes and Swedes still have a life. They're still creative. They're just rocking it. Here's two things that I see in those cultures that go across the board. The first is they hire from the best. That's a whole different subject and a whole thing that we as a Christian school movement need to address. The second thing is they give ample time for their faculty to collaborate and socialize knowledge. They do not run these crazy schedules that end up making them siloed and unable to engage with their peers. You are not running a more efficient operation when you have schedules like that. Or perhaps I should say it differently. You may be being more efficient, but you are not being more effective. And as a result, you are decreasing the value proposition of your school. And if you're surprised that people aren't wanting to enroll in your school, it's because they're dealing with a bunch of exhausted faculty that don't have time to grow, that don't have time to socialize knowledge, and no amount of you saying that they love the Lord is going to change your constituents' minds and make them write that check. Of course they love the Lord. They better. They're going to be at the school. So what we want to see is a faculty that is embedding professional development and integrating into their practice every day. And the last piece is I want a faculty that is child-centric. How many of you in here are child-centric, would you say? Student-centric. Raise your hands. Oh, you're like, man, you tried to trick us, dude. I know. What are you doing? I saw a couple, you know, like these. Every Christian school I go into says they're child-centric. I've never had one look at me and go, well, you know, Bill, upon reflection and engagement with our maker, it seems that we've been a little obsessed with the adult needs in this school, and we really haven't focused on the children as much. Never have I had that situation. And I want to be very, very clear. I'm not asking, do you love children? If you don't, that's a whole other conversation, which starts with you getting out of this industry. I asked, are children the focal point of our decision making? Now, of course, we have a Christian worldview, so ultimately God is the arbiter of all that we do, but come on, we're assuming that. I'm talking about once we get past we want to fulfill God's will, what is our decision-making criteria? And for all too many, it's what is convenient for the adults in the room. And then we wonder why the student experience begins to deteriorate little by little. The adults have all the power. They're in the boardroom. Well, their age, maybe not their adultness, but they're in the boardroom. Can you tell I've been a little frustrated with boardrooms? The great travesty of the Christian school movement. I just want to tell you right now. So here you go. This isn't part of it. But if we don't, as a Christian school movement, address dysfunctional, crazy sauce boards across this nation that are chasing high-quality educators out and creating completely unsustainable school systems, we will become irrelevant. The board is a big issue. But the board is full of adults. The faculty room is full of adults. The administration is full of adults. We have a really, really tricky system. Our primary constituent, which is the child, is not the one that writes the check, which is our secondary constituent, the parent. But make no mistake about it, the child is writing the check of their life, of their development, of their future. They have the most invested in the process. This is troublesome for us because we are a perennial people, and we are a people that believe very much, let's face it, not you, but the way I was raised, children are heard and not seen, and it was actually a very adult-focused environment. Some of that's important. Others of it was not so good. So here's what we see in healthy faculty cultures. We see them putting the student at the center of the conversation. We see them saying, how is this going to impact students, this new program, this decision we're going to make, this schedule change? What will be the impact on our students is always at the forefront of the conversation. Now, I know this would never happen at your school, but I commonly go to faculty meetings that last an hour to an hour and a half, and the word student is not uttered once. So if you want a healthy faculty culture, this is what you've got to have. You've got to have people who know the mission of your school and the essence of it. You've got to have people that are in and creating for themselves and in a predictable and supportive environment that has expectations, that holds people accountable, but that also comes with incredible resources and support and approves and approaches people not in a way that I want to whack the mold and catch you doing something wrong, but in a way that says I want to help you grow and I want to help you become all that you can be to serve the Lord your God. Healthy faculty cultures are child-centric and student-centric, and healthy faculty cultures are faculty cultures that are growing. Now, what does all this mean in the last minute? No, the last 3 minutes. This means that for many of you, you're going to have to reevaluate what it means to be an academic leader. Because it means that you're going to have to manage people. It means that you're going to have to stop reading about history and literature, at least not as much, but that you're going to have to start reading those people like a Drucker or a Senge or others and learn how to manage and learn how to have corrective action conversations and learn how to do a host of things that your schools of education and your subject areas did not prepare you for. It's a hard thing we do to division heads and heads of school. You know, I when I go back up to my study in Philadelphia, I'm surrounded by the great works of Western thought, and they mock me. Because the reality is I made a decision 13 years ago. I made a decision that the classroom was no longer the place where I was going to minister, that you were the people that I was going to minister to. And as a result of that, I had to make a behavioral change. And that meant I didn't have the luxury of reading Aristotle and Hume, but that I had to focus on things like Harvard Business Review and Drucker and these other things. So the first thing I want to say is if you're an academic leader, you have got to manage your people. You have got to learn to get past your nurturing nature that wants to avoid conflict at every cost, and you have to learn in a loving, supportive way to have the hard conversations and to counsel out ineffective faculty members in your school. We have a lot of stinking thinking about what grace and mercy looks like. I invite every one of you to engage the Gospels afresh and look at the figure of Christ. two things I see in my own journey as I travel with the Lord, and they both seem like they're in tension with each other, but I don't think so. I think that tension is healthy. The first thing is I see the humility of God as ultimately His glory. This glorious God that comes down to us and humbles Himself. A God that when here on this earth, before they were about to lead Him off to be killed for us, washed people's dirty feet. That was God washing feet. I'll tell you, as a believer, I just want to share this with you. One of the greatest mysteries of life that I will never understand is that God is humble and we are proud. Wow. How does that work? But right next to that, what I've seen is that my Lord and Master was fierce. That mercy and grace were not always His modus operandi. That sometimes He was like, look, you're not cutting it. And here's the deal. And you either show or go. Things like the axe is laid to the root. You brood of vipers. By the way, interestingly enough, those things not said to the world, but to those within the church of His day that were dysfunctional. We have got to be strong and we have got to love our faculty, but we've got to understand. Listen, almost every one of you here have a person you know shouldn't be on your staff. Come on, I know you. I've worked with you too long. You all, in fact, her name or his name is going through your mind right now. In fact, everybody knows it. The receptionist knows it. But you are creating some little theological game in your head where what would Jesus do? He could never fire her. He could never let her go. He would never do that. You need to go back and do some Bible study, friends. You are entrusted with those children. If you are going to keep an adult on that is not effectively teaching kids, this is what I would like all of you to do. I would like you to take the next 3 or 4 years of students and families that are going to have to be subjected to that teacher. And I would like you to put every family up in front of that teacher one at a time and like you to explain to their face why that teacher's ongoing employment is more important than the development of their child. We cannot afford a generation that does not know Him. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you've got to support your faculty. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow, but we're going to talk about that with money. Because it's a movement, so I'm going to say it. I am both sick and tired, both sick and tired of hearing that there's no money out there. If I go into your school and I actually do the data and then I talk to your board and your leadership, you underestimate your constituents' ability to pay by 20% to 40%. And you didn't even have to do that study to do that. All you have to do is walk out in a carpool and look at what they're driving. I don't want to hear anymore, we got a blue-collar community. You have a blue-collar community, some of which have large amounts of money in the bank and just are looking for a philanthropic engagement and something to give to. There is more than enough money in the Christian church so that not a single child who wishes to get a Christian education need go without it in North America. Full stop. We've got to get serious about funding this enterprise. All right, we're going to talk when we get back about, okay, so I want to work on this healthy faculty culture thing, but what do I do once I'm getting this healthy faculty culture moving to develop this prep and to begin to bond with parents? Sound good? All right, see you in a little bit.